Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Discipline turns wellness and self-care goals into regular habits. That's important to know, especially during a pandemic when routines have been upended for so many. We're going to talk about shortcuts to a new health and wellness groove. Wendy Wood is a research psychologist at the University of Southern California. Her 2019 book is titled Good Habits, Bad Habits, The Science of Making Positive Changes That Stick. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. Thank you.
Okay, so in the context, you know, when it comes to what is a habit and why are there good habits and bad habits?
Well, habits are just a learning system. They're a way we learn about the world. And with habits, we learn by doing. So you might think that you could make a decision like, this is New Year's. We're all thinking about how to change our behavior and meet our goals. And you might think you could just make a decision to do that. But as many of us find, it's not quite that easy. And that's because some of our behavior is controlled by our decisions. So if your New Year's resolution is to join a retirement program at work, you just have to sort of steel yourself, exert willpower, and make yourself do it. But many of our resolutions actually involve repeated behavior. They're not one-off events. So if you want to lose weight, it's not enough to eat healthfully today or to exercise today. You have to do that over and over again. And that's where our habits come in. You already have habits to do other things. So meeting a new resolution requires both forming a new habit to eat healthfully, for example, as well as changing your old habits, such as the diet that is causing you problems right now.
How much does the challenge fall into the issue of our ability or inability to visualize, you know, long-term, see the long-term manifestation of something? We're so short-term these days.
Yes, people are. And that makes it additionally difficult to change our habits because we think if we put in a lot of effort today, that should be enough, right? That should get us on the right track. And then that should just continue. But instead, habit memories change very slowly. So when you sit down to dinner, you're going to be constantly reminded by your habits of all the food you used to eat and how much you used to eat and eating dessert. All of that is going to keep coming to mind. And you're going to have to continually deny yourself those things that you used to like in order to meet your current goals. So, yes, habits have a sort of a memory of their own. They persist even when we don't want them to.
You write about the scientific study of habit. Well, I mean, there's such a thing as friction that is what makes it difficult to start new good habits. What do we mean by that?
It's a great question. So friction really describes how easy or difficult it is to do something in your environment, where you are. So if you live close to a gym, that makes it pretty easy for you to go work out. But if a gym is really far away from you, it makes it much more difficult. And research has shown that people who have to travel further to go to a gym are just less likely to do it because there's friction in distance. It's not how we normally think about our behavior, right? We think we're in charge and we make decisions and we make things happen. Excuse me. But what we're learning about in observing people's behavior is that friction is also extremely important in meeting our goals. So people who are trying to change their behavior should be paying attention to how easy or difficult it is in the current environment that they're living in, because that's going to determine how easy it is for them to repeat a behavior and form a new habit.
How does what we set as goals play into this? So, for instance, maybe I should worry. I mean, maybe the whole idea of losing 20 pounds isn't, it seems it's too big. Maybe I should maybe stop eating so fast, like chew my food longer, kind of break it down more.
Well, when you're starting a new habit, it's always helpful to be thoughtful about the pieces, the specific behaviors you're engaged in. And in fact, for anybody who has a new goal that they're trying to reach, I suggest that they do identify specific behaviors and then figure out how easy it would be for them to meet them in their current environment. And if it's not easy, then they can do things to change the environment. They can find a gym that's closer to home. They can take the food that they don't want to eat or don't want to eat so much of and make it harder to access, put it away at the back of cupboards, or don't have it on the table with you when you eat dinner. Instead, make yourself get up and and get something if you want it. That adding friction of distance, of a slight amount of energy, that effort that you have to expend to do something, makes it much easier for you to meet your goals.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I am talking with research psychologist Wendy Wood. Her 2019 book is titled Good Habits, Bad Habits, The Science of Making Positive Changes That Stick. If you've made a positive change in your life and you want to give us some insights about how you think you achieved that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. All right, so the pandemic has just upended so many routines. So there are lots of people that maybe were actually achieving some goals set in January 2020 that were then upended in March, 3 months later. What about the pandemic and how that's played in? It's got to be something we'll study for years going forward as far as the impact on our psyches, right?
Yes. This has not been an easy time for many people. And you're absolutely right. The pandemic disrupted our environments, our living environments, so much that it changed many of our habits. So people now eat at home more often, they cook more often, but they also exercise less, which has led on average to a slight weight gain across the US population. Some people have lost their jobs, and obviously that's a financial challenge that many of us are living through. And people have started homeschooling their kids because they have to. These are real challenges. But I've also heard that some people have said that they like some of these new behaviors, that these are opportunities as well as challenges. So a friend of mine who is now working with her kids on schoolwork says that she understands so much better what her kids are going through at school than she did before. And so she can talk to them about it much more than she could before. Cooking at home is never a bad thing. We eat more healthfully on average when we cook at home instead of picking something up at a fast food restaurant. So that is an opportunity as well. All of these are opportunities that we can try to persist, we can try to maintain after the pandemic ends, which we hope comes very soon. Given the current data, it's really quite scary.
It's going to be a while, I think, all things being equal. The issue of mindfulness has come up a lot, like living in the moment. And we're so used to planning the next vacation. And a lot of us, we can't even do that now. We can't even plan. Most of us are planning our gardens, and that's about as exciting as it's going to get. How much is mindfulness a sort of a habit that you have to develop?
Yes. Mindfulness, meditation, they're definitely habits that people work on and develop. Again, it's very dependent on the context that you're in, how easy you'll find it to form a habit to meditate. Most recommendations are that you find a quiet place, you have 15 minutes or so to yourself. Might be the same time every day, sometime where you're not being bothered. And meditating, mindfulness can be good for people's mental health, obviously.
Axios released a poll that found that last summer, nearly half of all Americans said they'd formed a pod or social bubble to help, you know, get that kind of support, that mutual support to get them through the pandemic. What do you think about that habit that people have formed and the value going forward when the pandemic is over?
Well, that's something that is protective now, health protective, to have a pod of people that you interact with and that you don't have close interactions with others. That's not something that I see as likely to continue, simply because it is meant to control contagion. And once we get back to work and start interacting with our neighbors again, that's just going to dissolve, I believe. It's not going to be a stable change that happens after the pandemic.
We are, lucky to have an incredible array of metro parks throughout central Ohio. I live near a really big park myself within, quick walking distance. And I've noticed how many people are out in the parks. And I'm wondering if you have any, and that's just good on so many levels, but I'm very curious to see, since I'm a dog walker too, so I'm literally out there every day, curious to see how that endures.
Yes, me too. I think that people who have adopted dogs will have continued reason to keep using parks. And in fact, there is data suggesting that having a dog is something that encourages people to walk more. And so is actually good for their health. The dog walkers tend to weigh a little less than people who don't own a dog. So that's something that is likely to maintain, simply because so many of us have adopted animals.
Taken on an added, the added responsibility.
Yes. Yeah. And so we will have that continued need to keep going out to parks, which is another opportunity that we've had in this pandemic.
It's an interesting thing, though. I mean, we've made it in, people who have adopted dogs during this time, or a kitten or whatever, they've taken on an added responsibility. They've invested something of themselves in it. And I'm wondering how, maybe some people say, well, I go to a gym and I pay for it, so I use it. That kind of a thing where you've invested something in it. Is there any research about whether that makes much of a difference?
Well, having a dog is more than an investment that you make once a month or some such thing, like joining a
gym. It's like having a toddler.
Yes. It's having a constant driving force, right, to go outside and to exercise. So that's something that will continue after the pandemic, that joining a gym, unfortunately, many of us do that or used to do that in January and then not follow through much after February or March. But dogs are different.
Yep.
Dogs don't go away. They're still there. So that's likely to persist.
Yeah. Wendy Wood, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Great talking with you, Anne. And if anybody wants to discuss this further, they can contact me on email, wendy.wood@usc.edu.
All right. Wendy Wood is a research psychologist at the University of Southern California. Her 2019 book is titled Good Habits, Bad Habits, The Science of Making Positive Changes That Stick. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Ohio began last week to administer the second dose of coronavirus vaccine to those who were first in line for the initial dose, including frontline healthcare workers and nursing home residents and staff. The next round of vaccines go to Ohioans age 80 and older and will be phased in over the next 3 weeks. Supplies are limited. Just 100,000 doses a week are expected at first. Governor Mike DeWine on Tuesday urged patience. He promised that as soon as possible, Ohioans under the age of 80 will get their dose, too.
I want to assure everybody, 65 years of age and older will remain priority. We know it's going to take a while. We have in the 1B group about 2.2 million people.
Still, questions remain about the vaccine and the pandemic. Dr. Ian Gunzenhauser is the Chief Quality and Patient Safety Officer for the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Anne. Always a pleasure.
What have you seen or observed from where you sit as far as the challenges in getting people to take the vaccine?
Yeah, there are challenges really across the board from dealing with misinformation and people's lack of certainty and trust in the process. This has been, extremely quick to market as far as when we first began researching vaccines and now when we've started actually administering them. So there's a tall order just to regain public confidence and public trust. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges we're facing. On top of that is the logistic challenge. This is a huge push for vaccination across the nation. And it's really not centrally driven. I mean, by and large, this effort has been placed on the backs of health systems across the country to come up with their own process for managing both the prioritization, making sure that that's fair and equitable and also timely and efficient, right down to the sourcing and sort of development of the vaccine sites. So this effort, I think, has encapsulated challenges that are social, that are technical, that are medical, and really challenges across the board. But we're seeing success in pockets, and we're seeing struggles as well.
Who are you most worried about when it comes to the issue of not centrally driven? Who do you think is falling through the cracks?
Yeah, I think that those problems are emerging really in different aspects of this. So on the one hand, you have issues with the prioritization process if that's not approached really with expertise and with a lot of thought. And the concern is that you may have high-risk groups that are falling through the cracks. I think right now, that's the group of the elderly and high risk. They are challenged in different ways. Many who live in assisted care facilities or skilled nursing facilities depend on the support of those facilities to potentially transport them or bring vaccination into the site. These are folks who depend on others for their mobility and their scheduling. And so there's a lot more that goes into getting them to a vaccination site. And they're a group that we really need to be administering this vaccine to as quickly as possible because they're high risk and because they drive many of our numbers.
What does it mean if you get the vaccine, you get both doses? Does that mean you can be out and about and feel safe?
I wish it did. So I've had my first dose, and I'm eagerly anticipating my second dose, and would be thrilled if that meant life went back to normal. Unfortunately, it doesn't. There is still risk both in acquiring and being infected with COVID-19. These are highly effective vaccines. Some of the most effective vaccines we've seen, upwards of 90% and sometimes 95%. So they are highly effective, but it still does leave a 5 to 10% chance that you can still be infected potentially. Now, if you are, in all likelihood, that infection is going to be much less severe than it otherwise would be. But the other big question mark we have is whether or not somebody can still transmit or expose others to COVID-19 after receiving the vaccine. We don't really have enough data to answer that question yet. And you know, that's a question of, can the virus still sort of live in the nasal passages where we know it proliferates even after you've received the vaccine? We think that the question is probably no or not significantly, but it's one that we're not really comfortable kind of dialing back our efforts until we know that for certain. So after the vaccine is administered, you know, still physical distancing, hand hygiene, still mask utilization, really keeping that social contact small, social circle small for the foreseeable future. But we know that as more and more of the population has the vaccine administered, we'll be able to start moving back to normal.
I know that vaccines differ. This is a different vaccine, obviously, than what we get for the flu. But what have we learned from something like the flu that is seasonal, that is spread in much the same way that COVID-19 is spread, about how infectious it or whether or not it still lives in the nasal passages?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, we don't have really a great answer to that question, even from the flu data that we have. I mean, we know or we presume that even after flu vaccination, there's still a fair amount of carriage, even with vaccinated individuals. But the flu vaccine is considerably less effective than these COVID-19 vaccines.
Right.
So it's hard to make an apples to apples comparison. I would say that we've learned more from COVID and from the COVID process that we can apply to flu potentially then vice versa.
You're listening to a Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the vaccine and we're talking about the virus right now. If you have a question for my guest, Dr. Ian Gonsenhauer, he's Chief Quality and Patient Safety Officer for the OSU Wexner Medical Center, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So in Ohio, we're coming up on 800,000 cases now. It's at 792,938. We've had, again, we're coming up on 10,000 deaths. We're less than 200 away from that. Hospitalizations at 41,863. What does it look like at the Wexner Medical Center?
Yeah, these aggregate numbers are staggering and certainly concerning. We're definitely seeing continuation sort of that spike that we saw prior to the Thanksgiving holiday really begin. Although, you know, there does appear to be, you know, some break in the numbers, at least here more locally. One can expect that the death numbers continue to increase because those are lagging metrics versus those high caseload numbers that we saw a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for us, in our medical center on the vaccine front, we just crossed our 10,000th vaccination yesterday. So extremely excited about how much we've been able to mobilize as far as vaccination and looking to extend that capacity even further. As far as the hospital demand and that element of this, we are seeing that ease a little bit as far as the hospital demands and demands for ICU care. But again, those folks who were hospitalized as part of that surge that was really happening and peaking a couple of weeks ago, we're still seeing the hospitalizations and the death rates that are a result of that. But hopeful that we're going to start to see those numbers downturn a little bit in the weeks to come.
The logic of going with people 80 and older, and then, you know, moving down strategically to younger, to 65 and older. You know, I get that. But we also know that the African-American community, people of color, are disproportionately affected by the virus. And there is an issue of not just, it's not a race thing. It has much more to do with social and economic disparities. How do you feel about the fact that that's sort of being set aside and they're going strictly by age?
Yeah, I don't feel great about that. I think that we've never had a more clear picture of how racism and social determinants can impact disparities in outcomes in healthcare. And so this is a great opportunity for us that I think we can be taking greater advantage of to really make sure that we are redirecting resources that previously have left you know, islands of underserved communities, we really have an opportunity right now to change that. So I think at the state level, I'm not seeing, you know, the type of conversation that's sort of leading us in that direction. But I know locally here, as far as our health system is concerned, that's a constant conversation for us and something that's really important for us to address. So in our vaccination process, we're going to really be certain that we're still providing avenues for our communities that have previously been lower access to access vaccines and access care.
I know that the Wexner Medical Center and all the other hospital systems in Central Ohio are part of a district that also engages almost on a daily basis with rural, hospitals and more rural hospitals and that kind of a thing. What is your sense about what's going on out in the rural areas from your conversations with your colleagues in those places?
Yeah, I think that they're considerably more challenged just due to the resources that they have in their hands. You know, for us in really what is a mecca of academic medicine, you know, we have just about every available resource one can think of to try and put together a really, really well thought out and really efficient response. As you get out of the city centers, you start to see more of these sort of small island independent actors that they're smaller hospitals. They're obviously less financially robust, less staffing robust. And it's a lot more difficult for them. I think it's particularly difficult for them to work through the scheduling and prioritization process. And I think one of the things that we'll see is a push to really open up that prioritization because the most important thing, while focusing on risk and high risk communities and groups and getting them vaccinated, more importantly than anything else is really getting as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible. And so if they're struggling with the logistics of moving through the scheduling and prioritization and figuring out who to contact and when, I think opening up some of the restrictions and allowing them to have a little bit more of a, you know, if you're available, come and get your vaccine, that's going to make things a lot easier for them and allow them to mobilize a lot more vaccine a lot more quickly.
A Florida physician's death is being investigated after the 56-year-old suffered a brain hemorrhage a little over 2 weeks after getting Pfizer's vaccine. Is this something that you're watching? I mean, is there any reason to believe that the vaccine contributed to that death?
Yeah, there's no reason to believe that they're connected. You know, what you see happen when we have new interventions and particularly pharmaceuticals and vaccines that have moved through the trial process and are still sort of in that late kind of phase, surveillance phase, we are hyper-vigilant about everything that could potentially be perceived as a complication of the medication or the vaccine. And so there's really robust reporting of all of those things, and we certainly investigate all of them to try and establish if there are any connections. So to hear about these things and to hear about them within the context of having recently received a vaccine, it's very normal. But as we look closely at that, there's really no reason to believe that there's any link. And they certainly are very isolated as far as the adverse responses that we've had to the vaccine itself.
When we talk about how people, if somebody gets sick, they test positive for COVID-19, what are their, I think some people were confused when former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was diagnosed, you know, tested positive for COVID-19 and said he checked into a hospital out of an abundance of caution. Normal people can't just check into the hospital, right?
No, you know, it's you generally to get admitted to the hospital, you need a pretty good medical reason. That's from both a hospital capacity and equity perspective, as well as certainly a payer, you know, a provider insurance company perspective. We have definitely seen really glaring examples of, you know, inequity in healthcare in the U.S. as far as things like that are concerned. If you are, you know, a celebrity or a political figure, you have the ability to do things like that and sort of get checked in as a precautionary measure. You're not seeing that happen for more normal individuals. And I think that's one of the things that is really difficult for everybody to stomach. I mean, we should have an equitable system that applies healthcare and healthcare resources to everybody as needed, regardless of their standing or stature. And I think we've seen some real examples of how that has short-circuited.
Let's see. Jeff and Hilliard, you're on the air with Dr. Ian Gonsenhauser at the Wexner Medical Center. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I had a question about the clinical trials and how the efficacy was really judged. Do you have any insight into the people who got the vaccine and also the control group, what they were told as far as do they keep up with social distancing? Do they keep up with mask wearing? Do they keep up with whatever their city, county, state guidelines are for staying at home? Because it seems like if you're trying to avoid the virus and you got a vaccine or maybe a placebo, you may still try to avoid some of those areas and not even really been exposed to getting the virus at all.
Yeah, you know, the way these trials generally work, really the expectation is that, you know, oftentimes folks don't know which group they've been placed into for the immediate portion of the trial, and then they learn a little bit later on once that efficacy has been determined. If that's not the case, and folks are not blinded from whether or not they're in a placebo or a control group or an intervention arm of a study, you know, the expectation is that they carry out their sort of business as usual. And certainly with respect to the vaccine trials, the expectation would be that really nothing changes in your behavior after you receive the vaccine. You go about your business as usual, and you're still exposed to that same risk on either side of the intervention or control arms.
Thanks, Jeff, for that question. Dr. Tom Frieden, he's former director of the CDC. He tweeted Friday that if the variant virus strains in the UK and Ireland become common in the US, we could be in for what he called a worst case scenario. What are your thoughts about those variant strains and whether we're far enough ahead of them with the vaccine rollout to avoid that scenario?
Yeah, so it's a big question mark right now. You know, the one thing we know that based on the variants that we have identified, and there's some information about a new one that we've identified here, right here in Columbus at Ohio State. Press release just went out this morning. We know that at this point, there's no reason to believe that the variant strains will have an impact on efficacy of the vaccine, but certainly there does look to be that substantiated increase in transmissibility. And so the hope is that, you know, we have multiple ways that we can manage that. One is that people really, again, buckle down as far as their precautions that we've had in place for months now, and that the vaccine, as that begins ramping up, we can potentially catch up. But it's a question mark. We don't know. We don't know how quickly that may spread and increase our potential caseload.
When we talk about transmissibility and the infectiousness of a virus, and saying that this variant that they're finding in the UK and Ireland is, it's more infectious, it's more transmittable. What does that mean, that there's more of the virus in a droplet, for instance?
Really what it means, I think most simple way to explain it, if you think about the virus as being sort of coated in Velcro, think of the little hook part of a Velcro. Basically, the virus is surrounded in that. And what the variant does is it makes those little hooks even stickier. It makes them better at sticking to your cells, which means that if you come in contact with the virus, it's more likely to stick, you know, into the nose or the nasopharyngeal passages. It's more likely to stick to your cells. It's just more able to kind of do what it does, which is stick to cells and then get in those cells and replicate. And so that's really what it is. It's the fact that it's better at doing what it's designed to do that makes it more transmissible. It's not that it's necessarily more infectious or more virulent as far as making you sicker. Uh-huh. It's just better at getting more people sick and spreading itself.
Katie in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question for Dr. Gonsenhauser is, what can expectant parents do to protect themselves and their new baby? Is it just distance until everyone in the family has the vaccine, or just wait until the baby's immune system has really matured? What's the best route?
Yeah, that's a great question. Hi, Katie in UA. And we want you to take care of that baby, certainly, and be very, very careful. There is sort of the jury out on vaccination in pregnancy. The CDC has really cleared vaccination for pregnant women. It's issued the statement that the benefit right now outweighs the risk. So the benefits as a result of being protected from COVID-19 when the vaccine is available to you is more beneficial than the known risk of potential complications. So that's probably one of the biggest things that you can do once that vaccine is available, pursue the vaccine. And then in the meantime, you're absolutely right. Just being really, really cautious, being careful with your social circles, keeping up your mask use, your hand hygiene, you know, avoiding those situations where you're potentially going to be exposed to a lot of people or any crowded situations. Really kind of the same things that we've been practicing all along, but really important for expectant mothers for sure.
Dr. Gonsenhauser, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on in.
Dr. Ian Gonsenhauser, he's Chief Quality and Patient Safety Officer for the OSU Wexner Medical Center. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up. We're going to talk about how to talk to your kids about what happened at the U.S. Capitol last week. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The chaos and violence that erupted last week in the U.S. Capitol was hard for many adults to watch. Explaining the attack to children has posed its own challenges. Child psychology experts, though, say that parents shouldn't shy away from the topic. Jacqueline Doxy King is a pediatric neuropsychologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital and clinical assistant professor of pediatrics at Ohio State. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And pediatric psychologist Parker Houston is a clinical director of a program at Nationwide Children's Hospital to break the silence surrounding children's mental health. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann, for having me.
Parker Houston, your 8-year-old daughter had questions about what she saw in the news. Tell us about how that conversation started and what happened.
Yeah, she did. As it was unfolding, she's at home learning, as many kids are right now. And so, you know, my wife and I are home and we're simultaneously trying to follow the news, but also trying to work with her. And so she was hearing bits and pieces of us sort of talking about it. And then we made sure to have a family discussion at the dinner table that day. But later that evening, she had some specific questions about, is something like that going to happen here in our neighborhood? Is something like that going to happen where we live? Or, you know, do we know anybody who would do something like that? Kind of trying to understand how this all came to be and what the scope of it was. So those are really tough questions for a parent to answer.
Dr. Doxy King, I was listening to something, a link on Twitter today by Charles Blow, the journalist, the New York Times, and it was about the Jim Crow period in the South and how they obstructed the vote. It was a history lesson. It was a great history lesson. And it made me think that there was a lot of violence in it toward African Americans. And I thought I could have handled knowing this when I was a lot younger. And I'm wondering what the science tells us about what reasonably, you know, with all things being equal, what children are capable of understanding.
Yeah, that's a really great point, especially with the Capitol protest and the ensuing violence. There were, you know, symbols like nooses and Confederate flags, and then also comparisons to Black Lives Matter. And so I think it, at any age, you can really start to talk about with kids about these things. So from those 3 to 5 year olds, you can start talking about fairness and the history of fairness in our country and how some people were treated unfairly because of the color of their skin. And then starting with those older elementary and middle school students, you can start incorporating more of those historical facts in there and relating that to what they may be seeing today and kind of how those symbols may hurt other people in our country and our society.
Yeah, it's a process of, it's like a building block sort of process, right, Parker Houston?
Absolutely. Yeah, you start young with what they can understand reasonably at their age, and their understanding of differences between people is usually down to visible characteristics at a lot of those early ages. They don't understand that there are lots of philosophical and ideological differences between people. It's just you look similar to me or you don't. And so we can start to think about how those play into social relationships and things that they might see in their community. But as they get older, the most important thing is to have an open line of communication about those topics, because whether we as parents are ready for them or not, sometimes kids will push those conversations. They'll come and ask you, and that's happened to me with both of my kids, where they've said, you know, tell me about this. And it's like, whoa, I thought that was beyond where you were right now, but let's have a talk about it. Let's look it up online. Let's find a good book to read, or, you know, let's sit down and talk about those issues. And sometimes kids really surprise us with how advanced of an understanding they get at an earlier age. Events like what happened last week and really what's been happening the past couple of years in America has really propelled that forward for many kids too, where they're being confronted with it on a pretty regular basis. And that's why, you know, Dr. Doxy King and I, among a lot of other psychologists, really feel like these are things that we need to help parents and teachers learn how to get more comfort talking about and sharing information about.
It seems like what happened last week, and let's even say what happened over the last 400 years when it comes to violence towards African Americans, for instance, and what happened last week in the insurrection in the U.S. Capitol, is really the issues are stuff that we should have learned in kindergarten, Dr. Doxy King.
Right. Yeah. All of these things are things that, you know, our kids are witnessing. And even if they, you know, don't have any direct exposure at home and in terms of school, you know, even if they're doing virtual or Zoom meetings, it's affecting either them personally or it's affecting their peers too. And learning about these things early on and building on them will make it a lot easier to, you know, explain the nuances later on.
I remember I used to complain to my parents, all we do is listen to the news. That's growing up with just three stations, right? Back in the olden days. But Parker Houston, what about exposure to the news? Because sometimes what we think of as the news is a lot of opinion. It's very, it's a lot of hyperbole. What, you know, and people listen to different news stations, right?
Yeah. That's a really difficult question, because it certainly depends a lot on the type of coverage you're talking about, the frequency, the way that they're covering a specific story. And, you know, I've seen opinions from people that I really admire and trust, ranging from please cut your kids off from the news at all costs these days, mm-hmm. all the way up to they need to watch it and understand how to consume it in a reasonable way, because they're going to see it no matter what. And so there's this huge chasm between what people think might be a reasonable response. And, you know, the tactic that I typically take is, first of all, individual characteristics of a child. So a kid who is really prone to lots of anxiety and concern about events probably shouldn't have as much exposure. But then also, I'm of the mindset of helping kids to be good consumers of the world and helping them to process the information that they get in a way that matches up with a system of values that parents want to bestow on them. So, you know, it is a push-pull, and I've gone back and forth. I've had my children read and look at some things that, you know, might be slightly troubling to them, but then we immediately talk about it and talk about the context. So it's really an individual decision, but the one thing that I think we can universally agree is not a great idea is letting kids have unfettered access to the news without any follow-up discussion, conversation, context by the adults in their lives. That's really the thing that can cause a lot of damage to their understanding of how the world works.
Yeah, I agree. And especially with teenagers, you know, sometimes it's harder to monitor what they're exposed to, especially on social media. But checking in with them when things like this happen is really important, because we know that sometimes those older kids and teens will cope with some of these things by fixating, which may make their anxiety even worse over time as they're repeatedly exposed to the news.
Well, and the idea of just watching the news together. Now, last Wednesday, I turned on the TV at about 1 o'clock to tune into the vote, and 8 hours later, right, turned it off. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. That's just what I do. But watching together, Dr. Doxy King, does that make a difference?
Yeah, it does. And it allows you to explain kind of the nuances and also misunderstandings that kids may have gotten either from peers or from other media outlets or social media. It allows you to clear that up with them too, and explain kind of the context. And we were talking about history before, the history around some of these things and the symbols that they may be saying.
Let's see. Cody in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Cody.
Hi. I just had a quick question with respect to the idea of having generations. So I was reading a couple different articles that talked about like the idea of, last week's attacks being sort of generational. And I'm just wondering, as far as when you have a group of individuals, those who may have experienced either Holocaust or civil rights or something like that, and, it's almost putting the burden on those previous generations that may have had exposure to traumas as a result of that, that perhaps how they process it and are able to sort of discuss it with the younger generation. Mm-hmm. Is that making sense?
Well, yeah, I think that's an interesting idea that, all parents don't come and adults and caretakers, Parker Houston, don't come to the table with a child from the same place.
Absolutely. And, you can't help but escape, or you can't escape the comparisons to historical events. Pretty much every story you read about, let's take the Capitol insurrection as our example here. Pretty much every story you read is, this is the first time this has happened since X, Y, or Z, or this reminds us a lot of this other event, whether it's in the United States or another country. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to put that into a historical context to understand what might the consequences be on groups of people, on a society, on a system of government. It depends on the angle they're coming from. But, as Cody was saying, it's really difficult for those of us who might not have lived through anything like that. It's hard for us to understand some of those contexts, and we might need to do a little bit of research and understanding and ask some of those generations. I've had some conversations with my own parents about, how did this go down for you? Mm-hmm. And what is this, what have you been feeling about it? Mm-hmm. And they've had some really interesting perspectives as children of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So,
Dr. Doxy King, we have about 45 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is a really good point. And for children of color and parents of color, they will likely come in already talking about these things earlier on, just to prepare those kids for what may happen. And so the conversations really are looking at their how the children feel about their safety and witnessing these things happen and worrying that, is this going to happen to me? Is this going to happen to my family? So it's more of kind of a direct conversation with them about what's going on in general that they should keep being vigilant and prepared for.
Well, Dr. Jacqueline Doxy King, pediatric neuropsychologist and Nationwide Children's Hospital and a clinical assistant professor of pediatrics at OSU. Thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Parker Houston, clinical director of the On Our Sleeves program at Nationwide Children's Hospital, which works to break the silence around children's mental health. Thank you so much for your time as well.
That's a pleasure. Anytime, Ann.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.